Across the room, Lisa was stepping out of her clothes. She folded each item of clothing and placed it on the back of the chair. She was wearing a pink bra and pink briefs that skimmed her pubic bone. No lace, just stretchy fabric that molded smoothly to her smooth body. She reached behind her back to release the bra. "I'll have to call you back," Rick said. Blondes becoming extinct. Endangered species to die out in 200 years. Last blonde in 2202 in Finland. According to the BBC, a study by experts in Germany suggests people with blonde hair are an endangered species and will become extinct by 2202. Researchers predicted that the last truly natural blonde would be born in Finland, a country that boasts the highest proportion of blondes. But the scientists say too few people now carry the gene for blondes to last much longer. The researchers hinted that so-called bottle blondes may be to blame for the demise of their natural rivals. Not every scientist agrees with the prediction of impending extinction, but a study by the World Health Organization does indicate that natural blondes are likely to become extinct within the next two centuries. More recently, the probability of extinction was reviewed by the Times of London in light of new data about the evolution of the MC1R gene for blondness. The jungle was completely silent, not a buzzing cicada, not a hornbill cry, not a distant chattering monkey. Utterly silent. And no wonder, Hager thought. He shook his head as he looked at the 10 camera crews from around the world now clustered in little groups on the jungle floor, protecting their lenses from the dripping moisture as they peered upward into the trees overhead. He had told them to be silent, and indeed nobody was actually talking. The French crew smoked cigarettes. Although the German crew maintained silence, the cameraman kept snapping his fingers imperiously as he gestured to his assistant to do this and that. The Japanese crew from NHK was quiet, but beside them the CNN crew out of Singapore whispered and murmured and changed lenses, clanking metal boxes. The British Sky TV crew from Hong Kong had come inappropriately dressed. They now had their running shoes off and were plucking leeches from between their toes, swearing as they did so. Hopeless. Hager had warned the companies about conditions in Sumatra and the difficulty of filming there. He had recommended that they send wildlife photography teams experienced in field work. No one had listened. Instead, they had rushed the nearest available crews to Berastagi, and as a result, half the teams had talent standing by, microphones held ready, as if they were waiting to ambush a head of state. They had been waiting for 3 hours. So far, the talking orangutan had failed to make an appearance, and Hager was prepared to bet he never would. Hager caught the eye of one of the French team and gestured for him to put out his cigarette. The guy shrugged and turned his back to Hager. He continued smoking. One of the Japanese team slipped through the group and stood beside Hager. He whispered, "When does the animal come?" "When it's silent." "So, you mean not today?" Hager made a helpless gesture, palms upward. "We are too many?" Hager nodded. "Perhaps tomorrow we will come alone?" "All right," Hager said. Just then a ripple of excitement ran through the crews. They jumped to their cameras, adjusted their tripods, and began to film. Hager heard the soft murmur of voices in many languages. Nearby, the Sky TV man held his microphone close to his lips and spoke in a stage whisper. "We are standing here deep in the remote jungles of Sumatra, and there, just across the way, we see the creature that has aroused the speculation of the entire world, the chimpanzee that is said to talk and, yes, even to swear." Christ, Hager thought. He turned to see what they were filming. He caught a glimpse of brownish fur and a dark head. The animal was clearly no larger than 2 feet tall, and almost immediately gave the low, moaning call of the pig-tailed macaque. The camera crews were electrified, microphones pointed like so many gun barrels toward the quick-moving animal. They heard more moans from the distant foliage. Obviously, a good-sized troop was here. The Germans recognized it first. 999! The cameraman stepped irritably away from the camera. Es ist ein Macaque! Soon the canopy overhead was thrashing as a dozen macaques swung through the area and headed north. One of the Brits turned to Hager. Where's the chimp, then? Orangutan, Hager said. Whatever. Where is he? His voice was impatient. He doesn't keep an appointment calendar, Hager said. Is this where he's usually found? Yes. Can we put some food out for him, something to attract him? Make some mating call? No, Hager said. No way to attract him, is that it? That's it. We just sit here and hope for the best. The journalist glanced at his watch. They want tape by noon. Unfortunately, Hager said, we're in the jungle. It happens when it happens. It's the natural world. Not if it talks, it's not natural, the cameraman said. And I haven't got all fucking day. I don't know what to tell you, Hager said. Find me the fucking monkey, the guy yelled. His shout agitated the macaques in the trees, made them scamper and moan. Hager looked at the others. The French cameraman said, perhaps quieter for everybody? Bugger off, you miserable fuckwit, the Brit said. Easy, mate. A huge man from the Australian crew stepped forward and put his hand on the Brit, who swung a roundhouse to his jaw. The Australian caught his hand, twisted it, and shoved him into his tripod. The tripod went down, the cameraman sprawling. The rest of the British crew jumped the Aussie, whose teammates rushed to his defense. So did the Germans. Soon three crews were swinging wildly. When the French tripod fell and their camera was splattered with mud, other crews began to fight as well. Hager just stared. No orang today, he thought. Rick Deal of Biogen was changing in the locker room of the Bel Air Country Club. He had gone there to play a foursome with some investors who might be interested in Biogen, one guy from Merrill Lynch, his boyfriend, and a guy from Citibank. Rick tried to play it casual, but he felt some urgency because ever since he watched his wife walk through the lobby with that asshole in white tennis togs, he had been in a panic. Without Karen's financial backing, Rick was exposed to the untender mercies of his other major investor, Jack Watson. And that wasn't comfortable. He needed fresh money. Out there on the golf course, with the sun shining and a soft breeze blowing, he fed them his little speeches about the emerging wonders of biotech and the power of the cytokines manufactured by the Burnett cell line Biogen had acquired. It was a real opportunity to get in on a company that was about to grow fast. They didn't see it that way. The Merrill Lynch guy said, aren't lymphokines the same as cytokines? Hasn't there been some unexplained deaths from cytokines? Rick explained that there had been a few deaths some years back because a handful of physicians had jumped the gun on therapy. The Merrill Lynch guy said, I was in lymphokines 5 years ago, never made a dime. Then the Citibank guy said, what about cytokine storms? Cytokine storms, Christ, Rick thought. He blew his putt. Well, he said, cytokine storms are really just a speculative concept. The idea is that in certain rare circumstances, the immune system overreacts and attacks the body, causing multiple organ systems to fail. Isn't that what happened in the influenza epidemic of 1918? A few academics have said so, but they all work for drug companies that market competing products. You're saying it might not be true? You have to be very careful about what universities tell you nowadays.
Even about 1918?
Disinformation takes many forms, Rick said, picking up his ball. The truth is, cytokines are the wave of the future. They are fast-tracked for clinical testing and product development, and they offer the fastest return on investment of all the product lines out there today. That's why I made cytokines my first acquisition at Biogen, and we have just won the litigation that surrounded...
They won't appeal. I heard they were.
The judge's ruling took the fight out of them.
But haven't people died from gene transfers that provoked a cytokine storm? Haven't a lot of people died?
Rick sighed. Not so many.
What, 50? 100? Something like that?
I don't know the exact number,
Rick said, now realizing that this was not going to be a good day. And that was an hour before one of them finally said that in his opinion, only an idiot would invest in cytokines. Nice. And so he felt exhausted and defeated, sitting slumped in the locker room afterward, when Jack Watson, suntanned and resplendent in tennis whites, dropped onto the bench beside him and said, "So, useful game?" He was the last person Deal wanted to see.
"Not bad.
Any of those guys going to come in?"
"Maybe. We'll wait and see."
Watson said, "Those Merrill Lynch guys have no balls. Their idea of taking a risk is peeing in the shower. I wouldn't hold my breath. What do you think about the radial genomics business?"
"What radial genomics business?"
"I guess word hasn't gotten around. I figured you'd know about it." He bent over, began to unlace his shoes. "I just thought you'd be concerned," he said. "Didn't you have a robbery recently?"
"Yes, my car was stolen from the parking lot," Deal said.
"But I'm going through a divorce, and it's pretty bitter just now." "So you assume your wife took your car?"
"Well, yes."
"Do you know that for a fact?"
"No," Deal said, frowning. "I just assumed."
"Because that's how it started at Radial Genomics. Minor thefts of physical property. A lab assistant's car from the lot. A purse from the company dining room. An ID card from the bathroom. Nobody thought much about it. Although in retrospect, it was someone probing the system for weaknesses. They understood that after the massive databank theft."
"Databank theft?" Deal said, frowning. "That was potentially very serious.
He knew Charlie Huggins down at Genomics. He'd call him and get the full story." "Of course," Watson said, "Huggins not admitting anything happened. They've got an IPO in June, and he knows it'd kill the offering. But the story is, last month they had 4 cell lines taken from their labs and 50 terabytes of network data removed, including backups of that data from off-site storage. Very professional job. Really set them back."
"No kidding. I'm sorry to hear that."
"Of course, I put Charlie in contact with BDG, Biological Data Group. It's a security outfit. I'm sure you know them."
BDG.
Deal couldn't remember that name, but it seemed he ought to know it.
"Of course I know BDG.
"Right. They've done security for Genentech, Wyeth, Biosyn, a dozen other places. Not that any of those guys will ever talk about what happened, but BDG is unquestionably the best when you have problems. They come in, analyze your security setup, ID your vulnerabilities, and close the network holes. Quiet, fast, confidential." Deal was thinking the only security problem he had was Jack Watson's nephew, but what he said was,
"Maybe I should talk to them."
Which was how Rick Deal found himself sitting in a restaurant across from an elegant blonde in a dark business suit. She had introduced herself as Jacqueline Maurer. She had short hair and a brisk manner. She shook hands firmly and handed him her business card. She couldn't have been more than 30. She had the tight body of a gymnast. She looked him in the eye when she spoke and was very direct. Rick glanced at the card. It had BDG in blue, and beneath, in small lettering, was her name and a phone number. Nothing else. He said,
"BDG has its offices where?"
"Many cities around the world."
"And you?"
"I am based in San Francisco at the moment. Before that, Zurich." He was listening to her accent. He had thought it was French, but it was probably German.
"You are from Zurich?"
"No. I was born in Tokyo. My father was in the diplomatic corps. I traveled a lot when I was young. I attended school in Paris and Cambridge. I worked first for Crédit Lyonnais in Hong Kong because I speak Mandarin and Cantonese. Then I went to Lombard Odier in Geneva, private bank.
The waiter came. She ordered mineral water, a brand he did not know.
"What is that?" he said. "It's Norwegian. Very good."
He ordered the same. "And how did you get to BDG?" he asked.
2 years ago, in Zurich."
Rick said, "What were the circumstances?"
"I'm sorry, I can't say. A company had a problem. BDG was brought in to solve it. I was asked to help. Some technical issues. I subsequently joined them."
"A company in Zurich had a problem?" she smiled.
"I'm sorry."
"What companies have you worked with since joining BDG?"
"I'm not free to say."
Rick frowned. He was thinking this was going to be a very weird interview if she couldn't tell him anything.
"You realize," she said, "that data theft is a global concern. It affects companies around the world. Estimated losses of 1 trillion euros annually. No company wishes its problems made public, so we respect the privacy of our clients."
Rick said, "What exactly can you tell me?"
"Think of any large banking or scientific or pharmaceutical firm. We have probably done work for them."
"Very discreet."
"As we will be discreet with you. We will send only 3 persons to your company, including me. We will identify ourselves as due diligence accountants for a VC firm that is thinking of investing. We will spend 1 week reviewing your status and then report to you."
Very straightforward. Very direct. He tried to focus on what she was saying, but he found her beauty distracting. She did not make the slightest sexual gesture, not a glance, not a body movement, not a touch. Yet she was immensely sexy. No bra, he could see that. Firm breasts beneath a silk blouse.
"Mr. Deal?" she said.
She was staring at him. He must have drifted off. "I'm sorry," he shook his head. "It's been a very difficult time."
"We are aware of your personal stresses," she said, "and also of your security issues. I mean, the political aspects of your security."
"Yes," he said. "We have a head of security, a man named Bradley."
"He must be replaced immediately," she said.
"I know," he said. "But his uncle..."
"Leave all that to us," she said.
The waiter came back, and she ordered lunch. As the conversation continued, he felt more and more drawn to her. Jacqueline Maurer had an exotic quality, and a personal reserve that he found challenging. It was not difficult to decide to hire her. He wanted to see her again. At the end of the meal, they walked outside. She shook hands firmly. "When will you start?" he said.
"Immediately. Today, if you like."
"Yes, good," he said.
"All right, then. We will visit your headquarters in 4 days.
"Not today?"
"Oh, no. We start today, but we must address your political problem first. Then we will come."
A black town car pulled up. The driver came around to open the door for her.
"Oh, and by the way," she said, "your Porsche has been located in Houston. We are quite certain your wife did not take it."
She slipped into the town car, her skirt riding up. She didn't pull it down. She waved to Rick as the driver closed the door. As the limousine pulled away, Rick realized he was breathless. It was just his way of relaxing, Brad Gordon knew, but try explaining that to anyone else. A single guy had to be careful these days. That was why he always brought a PDA and a cell phone whenever he sat in the school bleachers. He'd pretend to send messages and talk on the cell phone like a busy parent, maybe an uncle. And he didn't come all the time, just once or twice a week during soccer season, when he didn't have anything else to do. In the afternoon sun, the girls running around in their shorts and knee socks looked lovely. 7th graders, coltish legs, budding breasts that hardly bounced as they ran. Some of them had real racks on them and butts that were developed, but most retained an endearing, childlike quality. Not yet women, but no longer girls. Innocent, at least for a while. Brad took his usual seat halfway up the bleachers and over to one side, as if he were keeping some distance for his private business calls. He nodded to the other regulars, grandparents and Hispanic maids, as he took out his PDA and set his cell phone on his knee. He got his stylus and began to peck at the PDA, acting as if he were too busy to look at the girls.
"Excuse me?"
He looked up. An Asian girl was sitting down next to him. He had never seen her before, but she was cute, maybe 18 or so.
"I'm really, really sorry," she said, "but I have to call Emily's parents."
She nodded toward one of the girls on the field.
"And my battery died? Could I possibly use your phone? Just for a minute?"
Sure, he said, handing her the phone.
"It's just a local call."
"No problem." She called quickly, saying something about it being the third quarter and they could come and pick her up soon. He pretended not to listen. She handed the phone back to him, her hand touching his.
"Hey, thanks."
"You're welcome."
"I haven't seen you at any of the games before," she said. "Do you come a lot?"
"Not as often as I'd like. Work, you know." Bradley pointed to the field.
"Which one is Emily? The center forward?"
She pointed to a black girl on the other side of the field.
"I'm her friend, Kelly."
She extended her hand, shook his. "Brad," he said.
"Nice to meet you, Brad. And you're here with..."
"Oh, my niece is at the dentist today," he said. "I didn't find out until I was already here," he shrugged.
"Nice uncle. She must really appreciate you coming. But you don't seem old enough to be the uncle of one of the girls."
He smiled. For some reason, he felt nervous. Kelly was sitting very close, her thigh almost touching his. He couldn't use his PDA or his phone. Nobody ever sat close like that.
"My parents are so old," Kelly said. "My dad was 50 when I was born."
She stared out at the field.
"I guess that's why I like older guys."
He thought, how old is she? But he couldn't think of a way to ask her without being obvious. She held her hands up, scrutinized them, fingers spread wide.
"I just got my nails done," she said. "You like this color?"
"Yes, very good color."
"My dad hates it when I get my nails done. He thinks it makes me look too mature. But I think it's a good color. Hot love. That's the name of the color."
"Yes."
"Anyway, all the girls get their nails done. I mean, come on. I was getting my nails done in 7th grade. And besides, I graduated."
"Oh, you graduated?"
"Yes, last year."
She had opened her purse and was rummaging around inside it. Along with the lipstick, car keys, iPod, and makeup cases, he noticed a couple of joints wrapped in plastic and a ribbon of colored condoms that made a crackling sound when she pushed them around. He looked away.
"So, are you in college now?"
"No," she said. "I took a year off."
She smiled at him.
"My grades weren't too good. Having too much fun."
She pulled out a small plastic bottle of orange juice.
"Do you have any vodka?"
"Not on me," he said, surprised.
"Gin?"
No.
"But you could get some, right?"
She smiled at him.
"I suppose I could," he said.
"I promise I'd pay you back,"
she said, still smiling. That was how it started. They left the playing field separately, several minutes apart. Bradley went first, and he waited in his car in the parking lot, watching her walk toward him. She was wearing flip-flops, a short skirt, and a lacy top that looked like something you would wear to bed. But all the girls dress that way these days. Her huge bag banged against her side as she walked. She lit a cigarette and then climbed into her car. She was driving a black Mustang. She waved to him. He started his engine, pulled out, and she followed him. He thought, "Don't get your hopes up." But the truth was, he already had. Marilee Hunter, the pedantic director of the Long Beach Memorial Genetics Lab, liked to hear herself talk. Marty Roberts did his best to appear interested. Marilee had a fussy, pinched demeanor, like a librarian in an old 40s movie. She delighted in catching errors among hospital staff. She had called Marty to say she needed to see him right away.
"Correct me if I'm wrong on the basics," Marilee Hunter said. "Mr. Weller's daughter obtains a post-mortem paternity test that indicates she and her father do not share DNA. Nevertheless, the widow insists Weller is the father and demands further testing. You provide me samples of blood, spleen, liver, kidney, and testes, although all have been compromised from funeral home infusation. You are looking for a chimera, obviously."
"Yes, or an error in the original test," Marty said. "We don't know where the daughter took the blood for testing."
"Paternity tests have a non-trivial error rate," Marilee said, "especially in online establishments. My lab does not make errors." "We will test all these tissues, Marty, as soon as you provide buccal cells from the daughter."
"Right, right." He had forgotten all about that. They needed cheek cells from the daughter to compare DNA. She may not cooperate.
"In that case," Marilee said, "we will test the son and the other daughter. But you realize these tissue tests take time. Weeks."
"Of course, yes." Marilee opened the Weller patient file, which was stamped deceased. She thumbed through the pages.
"Meanwhile, I can't help but wonder about your original autopsy."
Marty jerked his head up. "What about it?"
"It shows here you ran a tox screen that came back negative."
"We do a tox screen in every automobile fatality. It's routine."
Hunter said, pursing her lips. "The thing is, we repeated the tox screen in our lab, and the result is not negative."
"Oh," he said, controlling his voice, thinking, "What the fuck?"
"It's difficult to run a tox panel after all the funeral preservatives have been infused, but we have experience dealing with that. And we determined that the deceased Mr. Weller had elevated intracellular levels of calcium and magnesium,"
Marty thought, "oh boy,"
"along with significant hepatic elevation of ethanol dehydrogenase, implying a high blood alcohol level at the time of the accident."
Marty groaned inwardly. Who had done the original tox screen? Had fucking Raza sent it out? Or only said that he had?
"And finally," Marilee said, "we found trace levels of ethocyanic acid."
"Ethocyanic acid?" Marty was shaking his head. "That makes no sense at all. That's an oral diuretic."
"Correct."
The guy was 46 years old. His injuries were severe, but even so, I could tell he had been in fantastic physical shape, like he was a bodybuilder or something. Bodybuilders take those drugs. If he was taking an oral diuretic, that was probably why.
"You're assuming that he knew he was taking it," Hunter said. "Possibly he didn't know."
"You think somebody poisoned him?" Marty said. She shrugged.
"Toxic reactions include shock, hypotension, and coma. It could have contributed to his death."
"I don't know how you would determine that."
"You did the post,"
she reminded him, thumbing through the chart. "Yes, I did. Weller's injuries were massive. Crush trauma to face and chest, pericardial rupture, fracture of hip and femur. His airbag didn't open."
"The car was checked, of course."
Marty sighed. "Ask the cops, not my job."
"It should have been checked."
"Look,"
Marty said. This was a single-car fatality. There were witnesses. Guy's not drunk or in a coma. He drives straight into a freeway overpass at 90 miles an hour. Nearly all single-car fatalities are suicides. No surprise the victim turned off the airbag first.
But you didn't check, Marty.
No, because we had no reason. The guy's tox screen was negative, and his electrolytes were essentially normal, given his injuries and time of death.
Except they weren't normal, Marty.
Our tests came back normal.
She said, are you sure the tests were actually done?
And that was when Marty Roberts began to think seriously about Raza. Raza had said there was a rush order from the bone bank that night. Raza wanted to fill the order. So Raza would not have wanted Weller's body to lie in a locker for 4 or 6 days while the abnormal tox findings were analyzed. I'll have to check, Marty said, to make sure the tests were done.
I think we ought to,
Merrily said.
Because according to the hospital file, the deceased's son works for a biotech company, and the wife works in a pediatrician's office. I assume both have access to biologicals. At this point, we can't be certain that Mr. Weller wasn't poisoned.
Possible, Marty said, though unlikely. She gave him a frosty look. I'll get right on it, Marty Roberts said. Walking back to the lab, he tried to decide what to do about Raza. The guy was a menace. Marty was certain now that Raza had never ordered the tox screen, which meant that the lab report had been faked. Either Raza had faked it himself, Xeroxing another report and changing the name, or he had an accomplice in the lab who faked it for him. Probably the latter. Dear God, another person involved in all this. And now Miss Prissy Pants was on the hunt for wrongdoers because of trace ethacrynic acid.
Ethacrynic acid. If John Weller really had been poisoned, Marty had to admit it was a clever choice.
The guy was clearly vain about his body. At his age, he had to spend a couple of hours a day in the gym. Probably took a ton of supplements and shit. So it would be hard to prove that he hadn't taken the diuretic himself.
Hard, but not impossible.
Ethacrynic acid was a prescription drug. There would be paper trails. Even if he got it from somebody, another bodybuilder, or a website in Australia, all that would take days to check out. It wouldn't be long before somebody decided to take another look at the body and discovered the corpse had no arm and leg bones. Shit. Fucking Raza. Marty started thinking about a 46-year-old bodybuilder. Guy that age, grown family, works his ass off to get a body like that. There's only two reasons. He's gay, or he's got a girlfriend. Either way, he's not humping his wife. So how does she feel about that? Pissed off? Probably, yeah. Enough to poison the buff hubby? Couldn't rule it out. People killed their spouses for less. Marty found himself thinking hard about Mrs. Weller, recalling everything that had happened at the exhumation. He saw it in his mind, the tearful widow leaning against her tall son, with a dutiful daughter standing beside, holding tissues for Mom, all very touching, except the minute the casket came out of the ground, Emily Weller got nervous. Suddenly, the grieving widow wanted everything done fast. Don't take the body back to the hospital. Don't take too many tissue samples. The woman who had demanded a thorough DNA analysis suddenly seemed to change her mind. Why, he wondered, had she done that? He could think of only one possible answer. Mrs. Weller wanted her paternity test, but she never imagined the body would be taken back to the hospital for examination. She never thought they would take tissues from multiple organs. She thought they would just grab a blood sample, put the body back in the ground, and go home. Anything more than that seemed to make Mrs. Weller nervous. Maybe there was hope after all. He went into the office and closed the door. He needed to call Mrs. Weller. It was a delicate call. There would be a hospital record of the date and time of the call, so why was he calling her? He frowned. Oh, yes, because he had to collect her DNA and that of her children. Okay, fine. But why hadn't he collected the DNA from the family at the gravesite? It was just a matter of cheek swabs. It would have taken only a moment. Answer, because he thought the DNA had already been collected by Miss Prissypants' lab. Marty considered that, rolled it over in his mind. He could find nothing wrong with it. He had a perfectly good reason to call. He picked up the phone and dialed. Mrs. Weller, this is Dr. Roberts at Memorial Hospital. Marty Roberts.
Yes, Dr. Roberts.
A pause. Is everything all right? Yes, Mrs. Weller. I just want to schedule you and your children to come in and give us blood and cheek tissue samples for the DNA test.
We already did that. For that woman at the lab.
Oh, I see. You mean Dr. Hunter. I'm sorry, I didn't know. There was a pause. Emily said,
Are you, doing the tests on Jack now?
Yes, we do some of the tests here, and the lab does some.
Have you found anything yet?
I mean, are you finding what you expected? Marty smiled as he listened. She wasn't asking about paternity. She was worried about something else they might find.
Well, actually, Mrs. Weller.
Yes? There does seem to be a slight complication, nothing important.
What kind of a complication?
The genetics lab found traces of an unusual chemical in Mr. Weller's tissues. It's probably a lab error, contamination.
What kind of a chemical?
I only mention it because I know you wanted your husband to have his final rest as soon as possible.
That's right. I want him left undisturbed, she said.
Of course. I would hate to see his final rest delayed for days or even weeks, Marty said, while questions were asked about this chemical and how it came to be found in his body. Because even if it is a lab error, everything from this point on is required as a matter of law, Mrs. Weller. I shouldn't even be making this call to you, but I guess I feel responsible. As I say, I'd hate to see your husband's final rest delayed for something like a coroner's inquest.
I understand, she said.
Of course, I would never advise you to do anything but follow the law, Mrs. Weller. But I sense that disinterment of your husband was an emotionally exhausting experience for you.
Yes, yes.
And if you didn't want the further emotional exhaustion of reinterment, to say nothing of the expense, you might elect a less emotional solution, and less expensive if you were short of funds. You have the right to order the body cremated.
I didn't realize that, she said.
I'm sure you never imagined that taking your husband's body out of the ground would be so traumatic.
No, I didn't.
You might decide not to put yourself through it again.
That's just how I feel, she said.
Marty thought, I'll bet you do. Of course, if you knew there was going to be an investigation, you would not be permitted to cremate the body. Certainly, I would never suggest you cremate, but you might decide on cremation yourself for your own reasons. And if that happened soon, later today or tomorrow morning, then it would just be one of those things. The body was unfortunately cremated before the inquest was called.
I understand.
I have to go, he said.
I appreciate your taking the time to call me, she said. Was there anything else?
No, that's everything, he said. Thank you, Mrs. Weller.
You're welcome, Dr. Roberts.
Click. Marty Roberts leaned back in his chair. He was very pleased with how that call had gone. Very pleased indeed. Just one more thing, for the moment, remained to be done.
Fifth floor lab, this is Jenny.
Jenny, this is Dr. Roberts down in pathology. I need you to check on a lab result for me.
Is it stat, Dr. Roberts?
No, it's an old test. Tox screen that was ordered 8 days ago. Patient name is Weller. He read off the serial number. There was a brief pause. He heard the clicking of keys.
John J. Weller, white male, age 46?
Yes.
We did a full panel tox screen at 3:37 a.m. on Sunday, May 8th. Tox screen and, 9 other tests.
And you kept the blood sample?
Yes, I'm sure we did. We keep all tissues these days.
Would you check for me?
Dr. Roberts, these days we keep everything. We even keep the heel stick cards whenever a child is born. It's PKU testing required by law.
But we keep the cards anyway. We keep cord blood. We keep placenta tissue. We keep surgical excisions. We keep everything. I understand. But would you mind checking?
I can see it's registered right here on my screen, she said. We have the frozen sample stored in freezer locker B7. It'll be taken to the off-site storage at the end of the month.
I'm sorry, Marty said, but this involves a potential legal issue. Would you physically check to make sure the sample is where it's supposed to be?
Of course. I'll send somebody down there and call you back.
Thank you, Jenny. He hung up and leaned back in his chair again. Through the glass wall, he watched Raza scrubbing down a steel table in preparation for the next autopsy. Raza did a thorough job of cleaning. Marty gave him that. The guy was thorough. He paid attention to details. Which meant that he was not above changing the hospital database to indicate the storage of a non-existent sample. Either he did it, or he had someone do it for him. The phone rang.
Dr. Roberts, it's Jenny.
Yes, Jenny.
I'm afraid I spoke too soon. The sample for Weller is 30 cc's of venous blood frozen, but it's not in B7. It seems to have been misplaced. I have a trace on it now. I will let you know as soon as it's found. Was there anything else?
No, Marty said. Thank you very much, Jenny. Finally, Ellis Levine found his mother on the second floor of the Polo Ralph Lauren store on Madison and 72nd, just as she came out of the dressing room. She was wearing white linen pants and a colorful wraparound top. She stepped in front of the mirror, turning this way and that. Then she saw him.
"Hello, dear," she said. "What do you think?"
"Mom," he said, "what are you doing here?"
"Buying my cruise wardrobe, dear."
"But you're not going on a cruise," Ellis said.
"Oh, yes," his mother said. "We take a cruise every year. Do you like the cuffs on the trousers?"
"Mom!"
She frowned and fluffed her white hair absently. "And I'm not sure about this top," she said. "Does it make me look like a fruit salad?"
"We have to talk," Ellis said.
"Good. Do you have time for lunch?"
"No, Mom. I have to get back to the office."
Ellis was an accountant for an advertising agency. He had left the office and hurried uptown because he had gotten a panic call from his brother. He walked over to his mother and said quietly,
"Mom, you can't shop now."
"Don't be silly, dear."
"Mom, we had a family meeting."
Ellis and his two brothers had met with his parents the weekend before, a difficult, painful meeting at the house in Scarsdale. His father was 63, his mother 59. The brothers had gone over the finances with them.
"You can't be serious," she said to him now.
"I am." He squeezed her arm.
"Ellis Jacob Levine," she said, "you are being inappropriate."
"Mom, Dad lost his job."
"I know, but we have plenty." "And his pension tanked."
"It's only temporary."
"No, Mom, it's not temporary."
"But we have always had plenty of..."
"Not anymore. You don't. Not anymore."
She glared at him. "Your father and I talked after you boys left. He said we would be fine. All that business about selling the house and the Jag, that's all ridiculous."
"Dad said that?"
"He certainly did."
Ellis sighed. "He was trying to keep you from worrying."
"I'm not worried, and he loves that Jag. Your father always gets a new Jag every year, ever since you were babies." The salespeople were staring at them. Ellis steered his mother off to one side. "Mom, things have changed."
"Oh, please."
Ellis looked away from his mother's face. He could not meet her eyes. All his life he had looked up to his parents. They were successful, stable, solid. He and his brothers had their ups and downs. His older brother was already divorced, for God's sake, but his parents were from an earlier generation that was stable. You could count on them.